Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Profiling Evil Podcast. I'm here with two authors, and we're talking about a murder that happened 67 years ago. Juliet Stanton Clark was murdered in her home. She was the owner of the Charleston Daily Mail. And every time someone inquired about the socialite's death back 67 years ago, someone told them to just let it go, to walk away, to forget about it. Well, I'm really pleased today to be talking to two people who just flat couldn't let it go. In fact, their story is going to really intrigue you, and they may have some information about this whodunit that you've never heard before. Please join me in welcoming Charlie Ryan and Mitch Evans, the authors of Murder on Stanton Road, The Brutal Death of Juliet Stanton Clark. Fellas, how you doing?
Doing great.
Doing great. Thanks, Mike, for having us.
This is awesome to have you on, and I want to just dive right into things. I was so intrigued, Charlie, as I was doing a little studying on this. Take a moment, tell people a little bit about yourself and why this book was written.
Well, you know, I come from many years of writing. I'm a journalism graduate back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, and I've spent a number of years in broadcasting in both radio and television, wire services, newspapers, etc. Then I started an agency and did that in public relations and advertising for 33 years. So those businesses became dean of the Graduate School of Business, and then after I retired, I started writing. So I had done five books, and I was looking around for another, and I hearkened back to many years ago, about 20, 30 years ago, and I was at a function on Stanton Road, and incidentally, Mike, it's pronounced Stanton there, not Staunton, and the Stanton family, Stanton Road, etc. So I'm at this function on Stanton Road, and the sheriff of what is known as Kanawha County in Charleston, West Virginia, is there, Danny Jones. And Danny had grown up in the house where this murder occurred. His parents had bought it after the murder. So I said to Danny, you know, that's a great story about the Clark murder. I think I'd like to write a book about that. Danny looked at me and frowned and said, don't go there. So I did not. And then 30 years later, Mitch and I are talking about the book that I had written on about a disappearance on Hilton Head Island. And we began talking once more about the Clark murder, and I found out that he was fascinated with it as I was. So we decided to put our minds together. Mitch had studied criminology in college, was very much interested in the history of the Clark family, the Charleston Daily Mail, et cetera. And Juliet Clark, of course, was the publisher and owner of the Charleston Daily Mail after her husband had died. And so that's where we began. It's an incredible story that occurred almost 70 years ago, and it is still a cold case today. And Mitch and I grabbed hold of that, and we are still trying to find and are finding new details about the murder.
This you got me. I'm gripped already. Mitch, you were intrigued by the sale of the domain name, the Daily Mail. Is this the same Daily Mail that I see online every day when there's a crime story out?
Well, it would have been at one time. There was an enterprising young employee in the days of the internet when the internet names came out, who actually scooped the Daily Mail of UK, and he grabbed the dailymail.com domain name for the Charleston, West Virginia Daily Mail. It was fascinating that he did that. It was also the case that the UK Daily Mail wanted that domain name for many, many years. And about the time that the newspapers were kind of merging and going through restructuring and some going out of business and all through the process, one of the last things that the holding company did that actually later came back to haunt them is something that should not have been done. There was a court proceeding about it. But they did finally sell the dailymail.com domain name to the UK Daily Mail. I caught on to that when I saw in the paper one day, the Charleston was a two newspaper town, a very large city at one time. And the news story was, we are changing our website name, and they were changing it to thecharlestondailymail.com. And that brought me into this story. And it just became more and more fascinating as I began to look at family history and very brief lifespans indicating certain kinds of tragedy for people of, you know, members of the family who were toddlers or infants. And just it brought me into the story. And this has been a very kind of a mute subject in our town. As Charlie had indicated, the mayor had mentioned that. But also there was an investigative, fine reporter in the Charleston area, K. Michael Reeder, who wanted to investigate and revisit this story several years ago. And she worked for the Charleston Daily Mail, wanted to do a revisitation of the story. She was told yes initially, then no, there will be no story. She then went to work for the Charleston Gazette, which is the surviving newspaper to this day. And at first she was told, yes, that would be interesting. And then in very short order, she was shut down. And we put that in the foreword, or I should say the introduction of the book. So Charlie and I got fascinated by it. And the fact of the matter is, Juliet Clark was a very strong, powerful, responsible business owner at a time when that was really either discouraged or frowned upon completely back in the 50s. And yeah. I thought her story needed to be told, and so did Charlie. So we had a very good entry to it there.
Well, you know, I want to just talk a little bit about your background for just a moment. You studied criminology mm-hmm. in college. I've worked for yeah. years with your cousin who was in the Secret Service, yeah. and we have talked cop a dozen times. But what was it about your background that said to you, I'm going to team up with this journalist and we're going to try to crack this case?
It was just my own fixation on, as I'm prone to be fixated upon things at times, and all the history began. And I just, it was an interest I had many, many years ago. It's not my normal fare. I'm a 38-year certified financial planner. So my study of criminology and anthropology and all these things goes back to the early days at West Virginia Wesleyan College back in the late 70s, early 80s.
We should actually be talking to you about financial fraud or something like that, not homicide. This is amazing. So you decide to write a book yeah. about the Clark murder, yeah. and you go over, and Charlie, he calls you up, and he says, I got to get a hold of this salty old journalist, and says, Charlie, you mm-hmm. should write a book. What was your response?
Well, the response was a very welcoming response. We've had a great relationship, and it's been a wonderful journey to research and do this book. I would say to you that Mitch is a great researcher. He spent an enormous amount of time talking with people at Charleston City Hall, talking with former Charleston police detectives, running down leads, banging on doors and demanding answers. And it was a critical ingredient to the book. We have a relationship. Mitch's wife is a godparent to my grandchildren. My daughter and Mitch's wife grew up together, and so there is a relationship there. But Mitch is a wonderful young man who has a tenacity, and it's the kind of thing that you need in investigative journalism.
Holy cow, I would agree with you. So, Mitch, walk me through this case. Tell me what happened on August 21st, 1953.
Well, Juliet Stanton Clark was in her home in the very, very fashionable district of Charleston, referred to as the South Hills, and on a road where the family built an enclave for their children and siblings on Stanton Road, which overlooks the city of Charleston, is exceedingly picturesque. She was married to the her second marriage was to Walter Eli Clark, who moved to Charleston in the early 1900s and founded the Charleston Daily Mail. He died in 1950. She moved, built a house up on Stanton Road. She's there alone with her nearly three-year-old grandson, whose name was Jay. She, around the time is estimated around 11 o'clock in the evening, she was savagely beaten in what we would look at and think of as a very personal, angry sort of a crime. One blow that she took, the autopsy said, would have killed her. After she hit the floor, she was beaten seven more times with an instrument of unknown type. Precious little evidence was left at the crime scene, except a very small wood chip about the size of your little fingernail, and a few unsmoked or partially smoked cigarettes. And her body was discovered on a green carpet rug in her living room. Her grandson was staying with her because her daughter and son-in-law had just given birth to twins, one of whom died just a few days earlier. So she was watching her three-year-old grandson, the oldest of those siblings, to help out while her daughter was recovering. Her daughter, also named Juliet, referred to as Julie, and she was watching Jay. Jay was unmolested, untouched during this whole violent episode. And the next morning, when her chauffeur arrived and houseman and her maid arrived, they found the doors open, cracked open. Many people in the South Hills left their doors completely unlocked. It was the days before air conditioning. This part of the city was known as being air conditioned, being a couple degrees warmer or cooler rather than the rest of the town. But they found her doors opened. They went in and they discovered her and were aghast to find her. And she was savagely beaten, and the three-year-old grandson completely untouched. He was perfectly fine.
These cases where there's blunt force trauma and this overkill that you're talking about usually point to people in the inner circle. When we think about being inside the home, we look at our level of risk in a case like this of being victimized by somebody unknown to her, and it really starts to get interesting. But Charlie, in a second, I'd like you to maybe walk me through who some of the original police investigators were in this case. But I want to tell everyone I'm talking to Charlie Ryan and Mitch Evans, the authors of Murder on Stanton Road, The Brutal Death of Juliet Stanton Clark. Charlie, could you kind of walk us through who were the cops? Because I love to know what the experience level is of the officers that are investigating.
Well, the word goes out that morning that the dead woman has been found. It's Juliet Clark, the publisher of the owner of the Charleston Daily Mail. So the police radio starts to crackle. And they come from everywhere with blue lights flashing, blue, not red at that time, red, not blue at that time, I guess. And so they go to South Hills and the detectives arrive. The police chief arrives. It is Dewey Williams, who is the police chief, and he has many, many years of experience. Lieutenant Detective Joe Kraft is there. And Detective W.W. Red Fisher. Red Fisher is a very flamboyant, colorful detective. They set about doing their business. Then, arriving on the scene is the flamboyant mayor of Charleston, West Virginia, John T. Copenhaver, known by one and all as Jumpin' John, because he's a guy that shows up at all the police investigations, so forth. So he comes to Stanton Road. he finds out this is a big case and there are big names, and he takes over the investigation completely. From that point on, all the detectives, all the police, they reported directly to John Copenhaver. John Copenhaver decided what would be done and what would not be done. And therein lies the situation where the case was really bungled, because there was not an investigation that was a true two-form police investigation. You had this overriding mayor, Jumpin' John Copenhaver, who was saying, do this, do that. He also was trying to protect the big names that were in the picture. He was protecting the son of Juliet Clark, Lyle Clay, who was one of two people that were the last two people to see Juliet Clark alive the night of the murder. The son-in-law, Arch Alexander Jr., was the other individual. So you have these two relatives, the son and the son-in-law. They're the last people to see her alive. Copenhaver knows this. He knows that this is going to be a case that involves friends, people in high places. Lyle Clay is the city solicitor, and Lyle Clay and John Copenhaver have a real relationship. Later, Lyle Clay goes to the Charleston Daily Mail and becomes its publisher and owner of Clay Communications. There's a lot going on here, and Copenhaver wants to protect his involvement in it. He wants to protect the people that are involved, and we find out later he wants to protect the police that may be involved. So you have a situation that is rife with control and rife with problems that are going to and did develop.
I mean, from the outside listening in, it sounds like not only politics, but corruption's involved in this investigation. Is that accurate, Mitch? And maybe after you answer that, you could tell me a little bit about who Juliet Clark is, what she was like. We call this victimology, or this study of the victim, because what we've learned over time is that instead of just going in and saying who done it, if we could somehow understand who the victim is and why they were victimized, it really helps us understand who the perpetrators might be. What are your thoughts?
Well, Charlie accurately describes Mayor Copenhaver. He was right out of central casting, replete with all the trappings of the day, including the Stetson hat with the sledgehammer accompanying him to all the dens of iniquity in Charleston, who were either serving bootleg gin, and in the book we develop the character of John Copenhaver, but he literally wanted to be a lawman, and he took over the investigation. Mrs. Clark. Mrs. Clark was a lady whose father, she was one of five children, and her father died when he was age 45. He was a former mayor of Charleston. The Stanton family was one of the early settlers of our area, and a town back in the 50s that was on the rise. And as Charlie points out, everyone who was involved knew without any question that Charleston, West Virginia, was destined to become one of the great cities of the South. It was on its way. Something happened on the way to that point of arrival that made it not so. But the Stanton family, the city would be a wounded place without the Stanton family and others who developed the transportation system, industry in the area, and she was an heir to that. Now, her father died. She was the oldest of the group, and she served to help tend to the family, and then she married. She was born in 1894, and then she was married to the elder Buckner Clay. He died at his age 40, very young. So she had been, she had seen great loss during her lifetime. She had to kind of pick up things and move forward. And it's exactly what she did. She remarried later in life to a man who was 25 years her senior, Walter Eli Clark. And he was a writer. He was in the newspaper business. He was a gold prospector, spent time in Alaska, and he was appointed by President Taft to be the first district governor of Alaska. And he's forever known as the first governor of Alaska. She marries Walter Eli Clark when he moves to Charleston, West Virginia, or sometime afterward after his wife passed away. And he started the newspaper. She inherited the newspaper, the principal owner of the newspaper at the time. She was given, as we understand, to great fits of depression and what they referred to at the time as nerves. She received, there were those who said she was so kind and generous to others. There were others who claimed she was a snob. But what we do know is that she was, and I pointed this out, it was also recorded in one of the interviews Charlie did. She was then the Catherine Graham of Charleston, referring to Catherine Graham, who inherited the Washington Post from her husband. But she lived that life before, the years before that occurred. And she was very involved in the community, a civic leader, probably about the most prominent person who ever lived in the city of Charleston. Her murder was the most sensational murder in the city of Charleston ever. And despite all this, to this day, even though the FBI, the state, the county, and the city were all involved, no one has any files at all about this case. No evidence, no files, even though the city had a file 18 inches thick. It's gone. And there's nothing there.
That is an amazing brain scratcher. I remember you talking about her public persona, and we often talk from the profiling perspective that there are three personas in our life: the public, private, and the secret. And by all accounts, your report, and frankly, she's good to be king because she owns the newspaper. Her social presence shows her as this lovable, dedicated person who's just a wonderful mother. Then there's this side of her that people don't get to see, that talked about some of the problems in the family. What kind of things were going on?
There was a daughter by the name of Julie. And Julie was the daughter of Juliet Clark and the publisher, Mr. Clark. And then Julie had two step-brothers, Lyle Clay and Buckner Clay, who were the sons of Juliet Clark and Buckner Clay Sr. So you had a situation where Lyle and Buck had a half-sister. The half-sister had half-brothers. And the half-brothers confided to their daughters later in life that Julie was very strange. And one of the reasons that she was supposedly strange was because Mr. Clark and Mrs. Clark had hired a governess by the name of Helen Slade. And apparently Helen Slade had strange ways and strange beliefs, and she was a martinet in terms of ruling over Julie. So the stepbrothers blame Miss Slade for Julie's eccentric activity. And Julie had penchant to like men in uniform, and that led us down the path to yet another individual that is involved in the case, who was a policeman. And the onion begins to be peeled back in terms of all the people that Julie knew, and then Julie's daughters come into the play also, one of them leaving and going to France, creating some turmoil within the family. The activities outside the marriage are mentioned. It is a family that has had tragedy, a family that has had personal grief. There were lots of different views and opinions within that group. And all of it comes together as an amazing story, looking into a social and prominent family of the 50s, 60s, and even into the 2000s as history goes by.
Folks, we're listening to Charlie Ryan and Mitch Evans, the authors of Murder on Stanton Road, the brutal death of Julia Stanton Clark. And fellas, I got to tell you, this thing is captivating, and I really want to dig in. It breaks my heart when you say that there actually are no documents available in the archives or anything else at the police department. Mitch, without giving up too much, who were the suspects in the case, and what made them unique from one to another?
Well, the reporter, crime reporter for the New York Sunday News, Ruth Reynolds, who covered unsolved crimes and wrote the book, it's a column book, Murder Round the World. She did a retrospective on this case, Mike, 5 years after the fact. That would be 1958. And she was the first one, and we didn't know this until we dug in, but she was the first one to report it that actually Julie Clark, the daughter, was actually 7 months pregnant when she was married. And so there was a lot of acrimony reported between the son-in-law and Mrs. Clark, the son-in-law being Arch Alexander Jr. The focus, he again was one of the last two people to see her alive the night she was murdered. The investigation really centered on Mr. Alexander right from the start. And he willingly subjected himself to hours and hours of torturous, interrogation. And then that was one of the chief suspects. There were others through the years that looked promising, but then they went by the wayside. There were, as it turns out, I believe, Charlie, it was 19 people who were actually polygraphed. This is another angle to the story, because the police file was missing. But the mayor immediately engaged the highest profile polygrapher at the time, who was presumably the father of modern polygraphy, Dr. Fred Inbal of Northwestern University in Chicago, brought him in to the tune of $150 per day to lead this parade of polygraphy examination. But right off the bat, it was Mr. Alexander. And the one thing that occurred was that there was just nothing. I think the mayor, well, my theory as to why the mayor kept this so close to the vest was a little more benign, though I don't know if that's accurate, if I'm accurate in this theory. I think he just wanted to spare the family as much as possible. There, as far as the grief, I think he wanted a slam dunk case. And before it got out and dragged on, he wanted to get it all together, keep it under wraps, and then spring it, get it over with. But the polygraph results were never part of the actual police file. And the reason we know that is because Fred Inbal personally wrote the report. No assistant or secretary with initials under his signature at all at the time. That went to the mayor, and the mayor kept those polygraph results to himself. The police did not even see the polygraph results. And so up until the time that we found out very, very recently that those polygraph results actually still exist, and someone came forward with that information, the prime suspect was Arch Alexander Jr., the son-in-law. And if you look at Julie Clark, the daughter, her life was very star-crossed. And one of the reasons why it supports the theory that it was Arch Alexander Jr. is that in a space of 3 years, here's what Julie Clark Alexander experienced. Her father died February the 4th, 1950. She was married later that year, being 7 months pregnant with someone's child. Then in August of 1953, she gave birth to the Arch Alexander III. We call him Jay. And in the meantime, in August of 1950, she was giving birth to twins. One of them died. Then 5 or 6 days later, her mother is brutally murdered in her home. And then just barely 2 months later, the 3-year-old child, Jay, who was with her, succumbs to injuries he sustains from a fire in the parents' basement. I mean, this is the kind of life that she dealt with. And she was raised, as Charlie said, by a very, to say the least, overbearing governess who did everything for her and told her when it was time to do this and that. And after that, she divorced her husband and moved to France.
I think it's also important to note that the polygraph report came out after our book was published. We received a call from an anonymous person who said that they had the file and they were willing to give it to us on the condition that, as the individual said, you leave me out of it. So not in the book, but it will be in the book in great detail in the second edition, which will come out later this year. The complete report that Inbal gave Copenhaver. And this has not been seen before. It was hidden in Copenhaver's bottom desk drawer and found only after Copenhaver's death by this individual or some other individual, and they kept it under wraps from that point forward. So then we found out that there were 19 people that were polygraphed. We detail who those people are in the second edition, and there are some interesting aspects of that. And then also other people have come forward since the book was published with other theories and other details that are corroborated by a number of people, and additional suspects are brought to the surface. We also have additional information on Arch Alexander Jr. from people who knew him well, and that sort of differs from some of the emphasis that you might see in the first edition of the book. It's interesting because as people read the book, they remember details. Some of them even diagram the incidents in the book and the people in the book, and then come forward and give us additional information. And as we speak, that is continuing to happen.
That's really something. Mitch, do the polygraph exams, now that you've had them, I assume restudied by a current day polygrapher, reveal anyone that wasn't originally looked at closely?
No. But the other information we've received does potentially shed light on someone who passed, who was ruled out of being a suspect as a result of his passing the polygraph exam. So it's actually the success they had on the polygraph exam that was intriguing.
Yes, it is. I mean, this is God of all. I hope your book is soon a movie, because it is a story that needs to be told. And I'll tell you, how cool is this when you've got politics, corruption, money, dynasties at play? I mean, this is a great story. Folks, I've been talking to Charlie Ryan and Mitch Evans, the authors of Murder on Stanton Road, The Brutal Death of Juliet Stanton Clark. How can we order the book, Charlie?
Well, you can order it on Amazon, and then it's available at various bookstores in West Virginia and South Carolina. And Mitch, beyond that, where would one go to order a book? I guess I could give you a call or me a call, but you can fill that in.
That's right. Yeah. The best place is our website, which is murderonstanton.com, murderonstanton.com. And there is information there as well that refers to the latest in the research. Charlie and I thought of moving on to a different case, but this keeps evolving, and so we're sticking with this to try to pull everything together we possibly can.
Stick with it till it's solved, fellas. This is a great one. That's great. Folks, make sure you check out the book. I guess one of the questions I'd have for you, Mitch and Charlie, is from time to time we have authors who will give away a couple of copies. Would you come on to choir practice one night and we'll have the back office run a drawing, and then you can send a book or two off to whoever wins the drawing?
That'd
be great.
We'd be honored. We'd be honored to do that. Absolutely.
Indeed.
That would be a lot of fun. And choir practice is a time when we just get together and we kind of loosen up and have a little fun. It'd be great to get you back. I am so appreciative that you would take time to go through this story. I guess the last question I have is, are any of the key players alive today?
No, the key players would all be deceased, but there are people that are in their late 70s and in their 80s who knew the individuals, and they have been a great resource. We're very lucky because these individuals, septuagenarians and octogenarians, have great recall, and they're very sharp, and they have definite opinions about the case. So that's the problem of dealing with a cold case that's 70 years old. But the more we deal with it, the more alive it becomes.
Yeah, absolutely. Mitch, just to make sure, is there any forensic evidence available? And how did the wood chip figure in? Because the investigator in me is still hanging on the wood chip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The precious little evidence there would have been is missing, along with the 18 inches of file content at the Charleston City Hall. I get the image of the ending of the first Indiana Jones movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, where the ark is in a crate and it goes into this other this huge warehouse with all the crates around it. But there's nothing. The city confirms that they have absolutely nothing, and maybe somebody took it. It was removed, taken. Maybe somebody took it home to look at it, but there's nothing at all. The wood chip that gave some suspicion, perhaps, to the type of wood you'd see on a policeman's nightstick or a billy club. The one that was produced for someone who could have been a suspect potentially, his was not missing a wood chip. At least the version of it that the one he showed to the investigators was not missing a wood chip.
But interesting. It could have been, I guess it could have been somebody outside chopping wood and it tracked in with their foot when they came into the home too, and could be a complete red herring. I will say, fellas, that I solved the murder of my great-great-grandmother, who was murdered in 1891. And believe it or not, I actually found in the basement of the county sheriff's office the actual arrest warrant from 1891, handwritten by the sheriff. So the beauty of talking about these cases, the beauty about writing books like you've done, is that somebody out there, even 67 years later, still knows something and may say something, or they may have a family heirloom, and it will undoubtedly end up in your hands. Thank you so much for taking time for coming on Profiling Evil. Will you guys come back again?
Indeed.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mike.
We would love to. Thank you, Mike.
Well, it's a pleasure. And folks, thanks for tuning in to Profiling Evil podcasts. If you or anyone you know is ever a victim of crime, or you know somebody that's being victimized, please reach out to your local law enforcement agency, your medical or your mental health provider, and get help immediately. These kinds of things do not get better on their own. You need professional help. And from all of us, thanks and have a great day.
Hey,
Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.